I was delighted to find that you were at Microsoft. I had no idea that the former chief scientist of Digitalk and Park Place was working for the same company that I do, but that's one of the things that happens.
Yeah, I'm still finding after, I've been here about 4 years, and I still find people popping up that I had no idea were at Microsoft.
Yeah. So in recent years, as you know, there's been a kind of a resurgence of interest in dynamic languages. And it seems that over and over again, people find themselves saying, gosh, what people were doing with Lisp and Smalltalk all those years ago has been the progenitor of all kinds of things that are going on now in the world of Python and Ruby and so forth. And gosh, that was just a long time ago. And in some ways, that was a very slow gestation period for a bunch of ideas and a bunch of techniques that are very front and center now for a lot of people. Do you think that's true?
Alan Kay, I think, is one of the quotes that's attributed to him is that it takes 20 years for a technology to go from sort of its initial invention, a programming technology, to wide use. So
yeah.
It's been 20, 25 years since Smalltalk technology really sort of escaped into the wild from Xerox, and certainly from my perspective over that time, you can really see sort of broad effects of that technology throughout the industry. In many cases, people don't even understand what the roots of some of the things they're doing and how it traces back to that core technology.
So you were at Tektronix back in the day, and I believe you told me that Ward Cunningham was there at the same time and was the first user of the Smalltalk VM that you were building.
That's right. In 1980-81, Xerox PARC Group under Adele Goldberg, that had been developing the Xerox Smalltalk environment, undertook an effort to move the technology out of Xerox, and they did it by working with a number of, I think it was four or five sort of major industry players at the time, people who built primarily graphics computing hardware of one sort or another. Tektronix was one of those, and so we got early exposure to what eventually became the Smalltalk books and a copy of the Smalltalk environment and instructions for how to build a Smalltalk virtual machine in theory, and all we had to do was try to build a machine and make it work. So, yeah, I was at Tektronix, and I led the group that did the initial review of that, and we went through a couple iterations of building virtual machines before we finally developed the technology to that was actually usable, where you could actually run Smalltalk and do real work for it. And it turns out Ward Cunningham was really my first user.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember the day of him walking into the room and saying, oh, what are you doing here? And I have this sort of breadboard layout on a lab bench, some machine where we had this machine running, and started showing him some things, and he said, oh, this looks cool. I need to learn about this. So yeah, he was really my first user.
And what were the tools that you used to bake that first implementation?
This was actually our the third implementation that Ward saw. The first implementation we did was actually written in Pascal using a Pascal compiler that I just finished developing, running on very early Motorola 68000 hardware.
Okay.
By the time we got around to the third implementation, it was a very, very finely tuned interpretive virtual machine that I coded in 68000 assembly language. And used a logic analyzer with in-circuit emulation as my debugging tool. I think to this day I remember the cycle counts of all the 68000 instructions, that very carefully tuning the dispatch loops and every operation on the virtual machine.
So what were some of the early uses of the Smalltalk implementation that you built?
Well, so you have to understand that when this was happening, this was 1982-1983. The IBM PC was just starting to dominate the market.
Yep.
The Xerox Star had just been introduced, which was really the first commercial product that had anything like a modern GUI environment. And so people were just starting to think about how to do more sophisticated user interfaces to machines. And so that was really the big challenge of the industry at the time. What was what today we would think of as a modern PC interface, what were these environments really going to be like, and how do you program them? And so Smalltalk was the obvious way to do that.
Let's dig into why that would be true. What were the properties of the Smalltalk language and environment that made that true?
Well, I think there's two things. At some very fundamental level, it was simply the fact that Smalltalk provided very straightforward abstractions for manipulating a bitmap graphics display. You know, bitplit is the primitive graphics operation, which for many years is at the core of all modern GUIs. And bitplit was invented to support Smalltalk and the Smalltalk UI. So Smalltalk provided that level of graphics manipulation as opposed to vector graphics, which had been the standard up to that time.
Yeah. We should take a moment to notice that the reason that Smalltalk did that was because it fundamentally had this notion of an iterative and exploratory style of programming that itself required a GUI.
That's right. That's what was trying to be invented with Alan Kay, was this concept of the Dynabook, which was this very GUI-intensive, friendly computing environment, and the initial versions of it were targeted at kids. And so, yeah, that sort of style of interactive environment was essential to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to be, in fact, my second point, was then on top of that, those basic capabilities was this extremely rich, very interactive, very incremental development environment with the whole concept of objects as an abstraction for working with it. So it was very easy to sit down in that environment and to experiment with new concepts of interactions, and it just took off. Given the alternative at the time was to sit down, code in C using some vector graphics library, long turnaround times for compilation and debugging. So
that alternative, nevertheless, did prevail.
Well, right. One of the reasons Smalltalk had a significant period of popularity and then went into decline was that it was part of an overall package that solved some problems people had at the time. And that problem was really, how do you build rich applications for PC-class machines? And so it brought along the graphics capability, it brought along the object-oriented programming paradigm, it brought along incremental development, brought along sort of general dynamic language capabilities, and as a package, it was clearly a solution to that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so many organizations experimented with it and adopted it, even though it wasn't clear which piece of that was the essential piece, because they got the whole package.
Mm-hmm.
And since this was a time of sort of transition in the industry, people didn't know what to do. And I think this happens every time there's sort of a major transition of application styles in the industry. Developers go looking for the new tools that are going to help them deal with the new style of applications. And they tried Smalltalk. Out of that, ultimately, what was widely adopted was the object-oriented programming paradigm.
Right.
Application frameworks.
Right.
The general style of GUI development. But ultimately, where those things got wide adoption was in the context of a different, more familiar style of programming language.
Right. I suppose one way to look at this is that it wasn't until the advent of the internet that the notion of a system which is based on message passing and is always running.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the internet is, right? It's this always running system, always continuously evolving, right? You can never version it or freeze it, really, right? It's just always running, and it's communicating by message passing, and that's what Smalltalk was on the individual machine. Now maybe we have an environment in the large.
Exactly, and I think that's why we're seeing such a resurgence in dynamic languages today, is that, in fact, the entire internet environment, you know, on a global scale is very much the sort of environment that Smalltalk was providing at the desktop scale.
Yeah.
A continually running, nonstop environment that has to dynamically evolve.
Yeah, I think that's right.
One neat thing about Smalltalk, if you look at today, any of the widely used, none of them are widely used, but any of the popular Smalltalk implementations today, Squeak would be the most widely used. They're all based on a virtual image of objects, a set of objects whose state is saved every time you run the Smalltalk environment. Mm-hmm. And you actually can trace historically a modern Squeak image today back to the mid-70s at Xerox, where Smalltalk images, sort of the first Smalltalk images were created and saved in binary form. And as the language evolved and the system evolved, those images had to essentially self-modify themselves to preserve their state.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a direct sort of thread of bits, you know, from those first images to the existing ones that people are using today. It's,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's not based on source code, going back, rebuilding a program from scratch. In fact, it's a set of live objects that have evolved over an extended period of time.
Right. Now, that, of course, is extremely scary to people who are in the position of needing to control and manage and, indeed, version systems.
Well, yeah, it is. And I think, in fact, it's one of the reasons that Smalltalk didn't catch on for the long term in the industry, that, you know, even though it had strong backing from IBM for use in enterprise environments,
mm-hmm.
the Smalltalk community and the Smalltalk vendors never fully dealt with those sorts of maintenance issues over time.
Mm-hmm.
And when sort of solutions that were more conventional in that nature came along, Java and .NET for that matter, they very quickly switched to those because it solved those problems.
Right.
But the Internet, I think, is a different beast. Because the Internet, in fact, is this same sort of nonstop environment we saw back on the desktop in Smalltalk.
That being the case, what lessons that were learned back in the day about how to deal effectively with this nonstop environment are applicable now? And how do you see those playing out? Or do you?
That's where the dynamic characteristics of languages like Smalltalk, and for that matter, Python or Ruby or JavaScript, come in. The whole basis of more conventional languages, statically typed languages, is the belief that in essentially an offline manner, before the application runs, you can sit down, you can analyze the entire application, and you can, you know, reason about it. And that's fine, but to do that, you have to make overgeneralizations, you know, about what the application is going to do, because you don't know what it's actually doing. You can just predict what it might do.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you declare objects that you say you expect an object that supports a particular interface, and that interface might have 100 different methods in it. That any object that you pass in to a method that's expecting one of those objects is going to have to support all 100 of those methods, even though the actual user of it may only need one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything that could go wrong in a statically analyzable manner with any of those 100 methods, like not implementing run one or violating a type constraint in one of them, is going to determine whether or not that object is usable in this situation where you're only, in fact, using one of those methods.
Okay.
What dynamically typed systems do, really the checking there is all done on the basis of what does the program actually do. That's what systems like Smalltalk were all about, was not about trying to do some sort of global analysis of everything that could ever possibly happen, but in fact is looking specifically at what does this program do and does it actually work for the real situations that occur. And again, when you apply that back to the world of the web and a extremely long-lived and changing in place application, you can't analyze everything that's going to happen.
Right.
Right. And you can't predict every change everyone's going to make, but instead you have to look at the system as it exists at some point in time and what's it actually doing, and does it work or does it not work.
So these systems are inherently distributed, and distributed systems are governed by interfaces that are declared in one way or another, and we've gone through generations of ways of declaring and describing those interfaces.
Mm-hmm. But those are effectively descriptions that are dynamically validated.
Or validatable, yeah.
At runtime, when it runs, those systems, in fact, say, okay, is this operation that the user is invoking on this interface, is it actually there?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key thing, is dynamic verification. I mean, those sorts of systems, those sorts of interface descriptions in distributed systems, there are useful things you can do statically to try to predict what the behavior might be, but nobody depends upon that for the running of the system. Mm-hmm. In the same way that when you compile a statically typed language, the compiler actually makes hard, you know, code level optimizations of what instructions are going to be used, and if something violated that at runtime, the whole program blows up.
Yes.
So I think that's a key difference there.
So this sort of comes back to be liberal in terms of what you accept and strict in terms of what you emit.
That's right.
You know, the notion is that we'll never be able to compile the internet, so we'll always have to be tolerant at interface boundaries. Dynamic languages are a way of implementing that tolerance, but it's understood to be happening in parallel to a discipline that is, however, still strongly declaring what the interfaces are.
That's right. I mean, it's you see this in dynamic languages all the time, is that one way or another, developers annotate their code with what they expect. You know, what type of object do I actually expect to be passed to me? What interface, if you will, do I expect this object to conform to? And I mean, that's necessary just for the original developer of the code to just mentally reason about what he expects to happen, mm-hmm. and it's necessary for people who are going to be consuming that code, calling it, to know what's expected.
Yeah.
But you still need, you know, those are statements of intent. But what the dynamic languages do is then at runtime
deals with the reality.
Yeah, that's right. Works with the reality.
As you now observe the popularity of languages like Python and Ruby, how do you see them in terms of their status as descendants of the sort of primordial dynamic languages, right? What's been lost along the way? What's been gained? You know, how do you evaluate those things in that context?
Well, you know, the thing I think is interesting about all these languages, and to some degree is even applies to Smalltalk, is, well, they were evolutionary experiments. The designers of them, in most cases, didn't always know what they were doing. And so all these languages tend to have warts in them, which when you look at them in, you know, in retrospect, you say, boy, you could do a much nicer, cleaner dynamic language knowing what we know now, but kind of these are the languages we have, and we have to live with them and such. So I think one of the issues we have today in people working with languages like Ruby and Python is actually understanding, you know, kind of what are the core features of these things, and which are kind of the warts that you need to understand and work around. So for example, just like Ruby, like Python has gone through a lot of evolution in terms of variable scoping.
Yeah.
What's the right way to do variable scoping? And there's lots of residue in the language from, you know, earlier versions of it, and what's, you know, is it lexically scoped or is it dynamically scoped? You know, this is all baggage that people have to work around, but it can distract, I think, from the core essence of what these languages are about.
To what extent do you think it's possible to decouple the essence of a dynamic language VM from the sort of evolutionary variation in the languages that run on top of it? So I'm thinking, of course, of the .NET runtime and the recently announced dynamic language mm-hmm. runtime. And also, you know, there's been a fair amount of experimentation on top of the Java VM as well.
Right.
So from your perspective, these general purpose VMs, as they now sort of reach toward a way of better supporting dynamic languages.
Taking the DLR, for example, I think Jim Huguenin has just done a fantastic job in creating an abstraction layer that captures the essence of what these dynamic languages are about and provides, you know, a common set of implementation abstractions mm-hmm. that they can all map into, which is then mappable onto the level of the DLR for the actual execution engine.
Yes.
I think that's really great. My caveat to that, though, what I, as a longtime implementer of dynamic language virtual machines, it's still the fact that the underlying CLR virtual machine is fundamentally designed to work for more strongly typed languages.
Right.
So there's an extra layer you're going through there that is, I think, is probably still not optimal for the dynamic languages, and hopefully over time that will get cleaned up.
So just to spell that out a little bit, from your perspective, would that, what you call cleanup, involve pushing some of the aspects of the DLR down into the CLR?
I think it may just simply be a factoring type thing. So there's a lot of things, you know, that get coupled in an implementation like the CLR, like the representation of typeness for an object gets tightly coupled into the CLR. So even though the DLR really introduces a different concept of sort of dynamic typing, it's still on top of this really deeply instilled basis of what is the type of an object. So every object in the CLR has information that says, here's the type of object this is.
Right.
That concept of typeness at that level may or may not be applicable. And it gets into everything in the system, you know, even the garbage collector. So the garbage collector understands what that concept of type is and then uses it to understand which fields need to be traced and which ones don't and stuff. So everything gets kind of interdependent on each other.
Mm-hmm.
As a dynamic language implementer, so one of the tricks here is inherently a dynamic language does more at runtime than a roughly equivalent static language.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, by definition, that's what it means to be a dynamic language, is it's doing this stuff at runtime. And so when you try to get maximal performance, the trick of a dynamic language runtime implementer is to say, how do I come as close as possible to minimizing the overhead of all these various dynamic operations?
Mm-hmm.
Right, and you do it by basically tunneling through abstraction layers. Right, you say, here's a whole set of abstractions that relate to, for example, dynamic method dispatch or dynamically adding and removing members. But at the implementation layer, I know how, in the common case, to kind of tunnel through all these and bypass all this very general mechanism to make the most common cases as fast as possible.
Which is what the DLR is doing, basically, right?
Only to the level of translating the language semantics to the CLR semantics, right? Right. It's not able to tunnel through the CLR in that same way.
Okay. But as I understand it, it's also caching objects, and so that a bunch of those runtime operations don't need to be recomputed unless things change.
Yeah, but again, it's caching at the level of the DLR, not at the level of the machine instructions.
Okay.
So us old Smalltalk guys, our goals in building Smalltalk implementations were to try to get them as close as possible to what C code would do.
Right.
And in general, I guess one of my comments about modern dynamic language implementations is that, boy, they've really benefited from Moore's Law.
Mm-hmm.
Most dynamic language implementations today are not at all aggressive in terms of implementation strategies they use.
Mm-hmm.
But the machines are so fast that as long as you aren't trying to directly compare to C-level performance, you know, they're good enough.
The interesting aspect of the CLR-DLR arrangement, though, is that as and when these performance improvements are made, they are inherited by all of the languages which are riding on top. So that's a nice curve to be on. But, you know, to kind of flip things around, it's actually really important, I think, to kind of explain why it is that this stuff matters, right? I mean, you know, why is this not just a kind of an abstract discussion among programmers about things that, you know, ultimately don't matter to anyone else?
So there's a classic discussion I've seen many times, and when people are talking about the merits of static languages, or in particular static typing versus dynamic typing,
mm-hmm.
and in dynamic languages, and, you know, sort of the classic scenario you see at the conference is a, you know, very experienced, very senior computer scientist who's worked exclusively in the static world, having a conversation with an equivalent person from the dynamic world, and the static guy says, I just don't see how you can build a reliable application, you know, using those dynamic languages. You're going to get all these runtime failures. right. Which the static language takes care of, and you could never ship a reliable product.
Right.
And the dynamic guy tends to say, well, I see where you're coming from, but it doesn't work that way. I've built and worked with teams building large, complex applications, and they just don't have those sorts of reliability problems you'd expect them to have. And often the static guy says, well, I don't believe you. You know, I can't accept that. It just can't be. And the dynamic guy says, yeah, but it's really true. I mean, I really experienced it. And so if you start looking behind what's really going on there, why is it that you can actually build reliable applications using this technology that waits until the application actually runs before pointing out some fundamental errors, what I believe is you find is that all these dynamic systems have been built in a very, very incremental way.
Yes.
And that as the people build them, they are continuously testing them, and all the problems that the static system could have found with its static analysis, the dynamic developers found just as quickly because they immediately tested them.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, when you look at methodologies like test-driven development and, for that matter, extreme programming and various agile techniques, they all actually tend to go back to the dynamic language development community and are trying to capture how people worked in those environments and carry them over to the broader software engineering community.
Yeah. Now, as always, I think it's important to note that this is not an either-or kind of thing.
Right.
Right? That these benefits are not mutually exclusive, although there's just this incredible tendency for people to want to make things black and white, and it's mm-hmm. this versus that. But, you know, for one example, Jim Huguenin is, in fact, not at all a dynamic language bigot. And as a matter of fact, my understanding is that Iron Python is currently implemented in C#.
Well, I just yesterday I was giving him a bad time and told him, a gripe I have with him is that his Iron Python compiler is done in C#, and it should be in Iron Python. And, you know, it's a classic argument. I mean, you know, he says it's a bootstrapping issue. He just didn't want to deal with the, you know, what it takes to bootstrap it. But
well, actually, he prototyped it. As I understand it, he prototyped it in Python and then moved it to C#. As I understand it, the reasons for that had to do with issues like tooling and programming in the large.
Mm-hmm.
What that simply says is not necessarily anything fundamental about one style or another, but it says something about the fact that right now in the commercial environment, in terms of tools and in terms of management capabilities for software projects, that the most mature stuff is in the realm of languages like C#.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, as a Smalltalk guy, my favorite Java development environment was always IBM's Visual Age for
sure.
Java.
Sure.
Which, of course, was a Smalltalk environment that had been repurposed into a Java environment. But, you know, when you talk to the developers of that and the users of it, you discovered that it was a very bimodal thing, that the people who had come from a dynamic language environment loved that environment for working with Java because it had all the dynamic characteristics they were used to.
Yes. Yes.
And everybody else totally hated it.
Yeah. It looks to me like we're in a pretty hopeful time here because, you know, I'm always looking for best of both worlds solutions, right? And
mm-hmm.
in this scenario, I think a best of both worlds solution is exactly the kind of thing that I see emerging, which is that on the one hand, you can have these dynamic behaviors and use them for what they are valuable for. On the other hand, you can have really increasingly seamless interop with the world of statically compiled languages and with an increasingly robust and comprehensive framework that encapsulates all kinds of things that are useful, and an extremely mature tooling environment, right? So, I mean, to me, this looks like it looks like goodness all the way around.
No, I would totally agree with you.
Yeah.
It's, you know, in the Smalltalk community, I always had the reputation as the guy who was trying to make Smalltalk more static, so it was more applicable for industrial applications.
Right.
In the sort of in the Microsoft environment, which is a very static world, you know, I go around pushing people to make everything more dynamic. And,
right.
and you're right, it's in
right.
the middle. It's the balance we're trying to find is how to, you know, best apply all these different technical variations.
So given all that, how did you wind up at Microsoft and what are you doing here?
So I've been at Microsoft about 4 years, and in the last 15 years before I came to Microsoft, I'd mostly worked in smaller companies. I mean, even Park Place and DigiTalk were relatively small by the standards of Microsoft. I guess what really happened is there was an opportunity to come to Microsoft, and as I looked at the evolution of the tools market, it was beginning to seem that it was very, very difficult, you know, outside a large, deep-pocket organization like Microsoft to actually do anything very innovative with tools and to get it out to the world.
Mm-hmm.
As a business prospect, doing software tools there's not a lot of business opportunities there. And so if you wanted to be innovative, you needed to be in an organization that had you know, a broader perspective on why this technology is important. And so I decided to give Microsoft a try. And at the time I came there, it wasn't about dynamic languages at all. I actually went into the Visual Studio organization and was working on the architecture of a project that it's not a public project, but it's basically a project that's about future architecture for various versions of Visual Studio.
Okay.
So I did that for 3.5 years, and then earlier this year, you know, as more and more dynamic language stuff is starting to happen at Microsoft, I sort of said, I think both for me and for Microsoft, it's good to start leveraging some of my background in dynamic languages. And so I this year went into a position where I'm working within the Visual Studio organization, doing a lot of work with the leadership in terms of kind of understanding overall language strategies, how dynamic languages fit in, how they relate to the static languages, where we should be going with them. So sort of more medium to longer term strategy about what Microsoft should be doing with these technologies.
It's really great to hear that. I think this is always true. There's just all kinds of stuff going on at Microsoft that, you know, because there is so much of it in so many places, it's just not apparent in a lot of cases who's doing what and who's even there, right? Like, I didn't know you were.
Right, right.
That's great to hear. I think that, especially obviously in light of the Mix announcements, it's become very clear that this commitment or this interest in dynamic languages is more than a passing fancy, right? It's starting to look like a pretty serious initiative.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, there's still lots of questions, and there's still plenty of people, both inside and outside of Microsoft, who will question whether or not dynamic languages is just another passing fad again, or whether it's here for the long term. And that's really what we're all trying to figure out and make our plans around. How is this going to evolve over time?
Cool. Well, thanks, Alan.
Yeah, no, John, I really like the chance here to kind of tell you about some of this ancient history here of dynamic languages and how it relates to what we're doing today.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, thanks a lot.